gonna sheesh for being here with us today. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Every piece of land has a story that time has a way of erasing, and that seems to be a bigger problem for Alaska's indigenous peoples, who have ties that go back more than 1,000 years. But Sea Alaska Heritage Institute has published a new book as part of the Institute's Book of Knowledge series about Indian Point, land on the outskirts of Juneau that is a sacred site in Klinkit-Aini. The book is called National Recognition of the Traditional Significance of Indian Point, originally known as Kunahai. The book is a compilation of research from three authors, and I talked with two of them, Dr. Rosita Wuerl, president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and Dr. Chuck Smythe, the Institute's chief ethnologist.
I guess we should start off with Indian Point. Indian Point, which is located right across the ferry terminal here in Juneau, it is a sacred site to Tlingit people and to the Occoquan people. Even though I'm not Ok, I still grew up knowing that it was a sacred site. Our people, the Tlingit people, the Ok people, have tried to protect that site from development for at least 60, 70 years.
So what is the story of that piece of property? In Western terms, they would refer to it as property, but obviously it was much more than that.
Well, there were a number of dimensions of importance that it has. And one is for subsistence. It was a herring area, what's called Indian Cove. The original name was Herring Cove. And that was an important herring harvest area for the Ok people and the people in this community. Many people would go there. Chris McNeil's father had a herring pound there.
What is a herring pound?
It's like a pen where they would bring herring that they've caught and put them in there and then sell them to fishermen. So it's a sort of way you keep herring alive.
So it was a commercial fishing operation.
That one was, yeah. But there were herring camps along the beach on that side, and herring were all over. They spawned on the rocks. They spawned on the other side in the inner cove. That's the first resource that comes to mind that now we don't have there.
So, Chuck, when did the herring disappear?
It was, I want to say, in about 1970. It's whenever Fish and Game authorized the last herring commercial fishery there, and that ended it.
Ended probably thousands of years of tradition of harvesting that resource?
Well, sure. That would be one of the resources that attracted the Ok people here to the first place. You know, when they were looking for places to live, they came there, and because of the resources that were there and in this area. So
the resource is one thing that made that land special. What else stands out?
Well, it has historical significance for its association with an Ok leader. There was kind of a showdown with a Yakutat leader that came down and transited the area but didn't stop. See, under Tlingit protocol, you're supposed to, when you travel past a village, you're supposed to stop and say, "I'm here," and wait to be greeted and invited in, and then you explain what your purpose is and where you're going and all. And then you're basically sent on your way after that. It's a matter of courtesy and protocol to do that. And so this individual didn't do that. And then on the way back, he came back through and did it at that time. And he was invited in, and at the same time, the Ok leader took the prow of his canoe and put it in the fire, insulted him that way. And so this man got all upset. This Yakutat leader got all upset and went to his canoe and started to throw coppers overboard. So he did it once, and then the Ok leader did it another in response, and then that went back and forth. And then the Yakutat leader threw something that looked like copper, but it turned out it was something wrapped, a heavy object wrapped in bark, because he had run out of copper. And then the bark floated to the surface, and his subterfuge was discovered. And so he lost face. And this man, this Auk chief or leader, took a new name called Suddenly Rich Man, or came into wealth suddenly. And that's really important to do. And that was recorded in a song that was recorded by John Swanton in 1904 and published by the Smithsonian. So we know that history goes back for quite a while.
So for those people who are not familiar, what are coppers?
Coppers are a distinctly shaped solid piece of copper that is a symbol of power and wealth for the Tlingit people. And so they have them as Clan At'u, as heirloom property that's handed down within the clan and shows their influence. It's just a symbol of wealth.
Boy, that's quite an image of throwing copper bars overboard. So where did this copper come from?
Well, originally the source was the Copper River.
And makes
sense. And it was acquired in trade, and it would be traded down. And then later on, with the advent of Europeans, that sometimes copper was acquired from the hulls of ships. They would put copper sheeting on the bottom of ships to protect them, the wooden ships.
So was the fact that this chief was supposed to, from Yakutat, was supposed to stop and pay his respects, was that particular spot important to that? Was that the proper place because it was a valued piece of land?
Well, it was where the village was initially, the principal village, and also it had high cliffs on the southern end and where lookouts would be stationed to watch for this sort of thing and to watch for enemies. Tlingit people were vulnerable when they lived in these communities on the coast to attack and whatever. So this was a special place because it had these high promontories that served as lookouts.
I think it's important to stress that it was the protocol when you're entering someone else's territory that you would pay respect to the owner of that property. And so what the Yakutat person did was he failed to acknowledge the protocol of going in and recognizing the leader of the Auk people. So it was a violation of protocol. I mean, it would be just like us going to a foreign country and not, you know, having our passport and just getting into that country without those formalities. And so there was that violation. And so the Auk leader took upon himself to demonstrate his anger by burning the prow of his canoe. And then this exchange that they had of throwing copper into the sea was in like competition to say and show who was the wealthier, who had the higher status of the two. And in the end, the Auk person, you know, demonstrated his superiority.
That's quite a good story. You could see why it would live on.
Yeah, and the fact that this guy, the Auk man, took a name and a song was composed, that's common with significant events, historical events in the history of a clan.
I mean, we were talking about the significance of Indian Point, and so Chuck pointed out it's important for its food resources, the historical events there that happened at the village. There was a village there. But the other dimensions of Indian Point are it's a burial site and a burial site for shamans. And so there are the spiritual dimensions that make it especially significant to us and a site that we know we needed to protect.
So when mining came to Juneau and hordes of people came, how did that change?
Well, we know that, and this is Chuck's area, historical area, where we know the Auk people had actually moved a village to the village downtown. And they were living all around in the Juneau area, and then they consolidated in the village. But there was definitely an effort to move Tlingit people, Auk people, away from their land, or like in the Taku, who had settled in Douglas. They were forcibly removed and their homes burned.
And that is a story that would be interesting to delve into, because I think it's a piece of history, for all intents and purposes, has kind of been erased, that not a lot of people are aware of it. And I'm sure with this piece of sacred land, it's the same story, that a lot of its story has been erased into our modern consciousness.
These folks had moved from this place around the point to what is now known as Elk Rec. In 1879 or 1880, I can't remember exactly when, but the Navy came there and said, the gold has been discovered in Juneau, and next year we want you to move into Juneau, because they'll, and of course it wasn't called Juneau at that time, it was called Santa Kahini. But the Navy said, we want you to move in there because they're going to need miners and people to carry wood and do things like that. So they encouraged the Auk people to leave that village, and which they did over the next 15, 20 years or so, and moved into what became the Indian Village in downtown Juneau. But what people don't know here is that they actually lived right at the center, right next to the main dock that was built by the miners in what is the center of downtown Juneau. And in 1881, they outnumbered the miners 3-1. But the Navy said, well, there's going to be a problem here with interactions, and particularly when white people start selling alcohol to the natives and stuff. And they were afraid of violence occurring between the natives and the miners. And so they encouraged the native people to move out of Juneau and move over around the point in downtown Juneau, which is now known as Telephone Hill, to the place of the Indian Village. So they actually excluded them. And so at the end of that 1881, at the end of that summer, the natives were basically excluded from downtown Juneau, and it remained that way for many, many years, because they had their own community, and they were told to stay there. And there was a tourist that came by that year and reported that there was a Gatling gun put on the top of Telephone Hill aimed at the village.
So they go from having a very large footprint to being moved all over the place whenever the government had a whim to move people.
Yeah, I mean, it was after they were asked and entreated to come down and help the miners. A short time later, they were excluded. So when you see the first plat of Juneau, you see the city, nice square blocks, streets, and then to the left, you have the Auk Indian Village with no streets and no anything on the map. And that's why in the border was that street that's behind the governor's mansion. It's still called Indian Street.
Interesting, interesting that just a few vestiges remain of what is an incredible story. People were moved to Auk Rec and then moved downtown and then pushed out again. But did the land get encroached upon Indian Point?
Well, the government began to select land there and take the land. So we had Park Service moving in there. First of all, it became Park Service land over the objection of the Auk people. And they built a cabin house and their dock, and it became like the service center for Glacier Bay. And then you have the city acquiring land on Indian Point, and then we also have BLM acquiring land there. They took ownership of the burial sites, the shamanic sites. And then you have the city in the late 1960s wanting to subdivide their land there and to sell them for lots. And the Native community came together in the late 1960s and opposed the division of that land for houses, for residential units. We wanted to protect the sacredness of Indian Point, because by that time, subsistence, the herring had been wiped out. When I was growing up, thanks to the Aquan, they had allowed us who were not from this area, they had allowed us to go out there to pick berries and to gather herring eggs. But by the late 60s, it was all destroyed. So anyway, in the late 60s, we fought against the city subdivision of that land just to protect it. And I always like to acknowledge this, is that we did have supporters who came to the defense, or maybe for different reasons, they wanted to maintain the pristine nature of Indian Point. Maybe they wanted to protect it for that, but we wanted to protect it for its sacred dimensions. And so it coalesced, so the city at that point in time gave up on subdividing the land into residential lots.
So the story of the land continues. So let's take a short break, and then when we come back, we'll talk about how you wound up getting the land on the historic register and some of those other steps. In case you've just joined us, we've been talking with Dr. Rosita Worrell, head of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and Dr. Chuck Smythe, SHI's senior ethnologist. We have been hearing about the battle, the long battle, to have Indian Point win national recognition as land of traditional cultural significance. When we come back, more on what it took to make this happen.
I have to say that I see Indian Point through a very personal lens. Even though I'm a Chilkat, I grew up knowing that Indian Point belonged to the Ok people.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Welcome back. In case you've just joined us, we have been hearing from Dr. Rosita Worrell and Dr. Chuck Smythe from Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. They've been telling us the story of Indian Point, or Kunakai, in the Thlinkit language. So when last we left off, we were talking about how that land at Indian Point had changed, and it lost its original character, it lost its resources, it lost its people.
Never the sacred dimensions stay, right?
I wouldn't go that far. I think it still had integrity as a place that had not been developed. I mean, the Park Service in 1959 acquired one quadrant of the area and built a house there. And the Native community and organizations in Juneau got together and objected to that. And so the Park Service created an easement across their land for the use of Native people to go down to their herring camps. The rest of the place was not compromised in any way because it was still maintained in its original state. So then it was 1969, what Rosita was talking about, where the city of Juneau wanted to develop, subdivide Indian Point. And it was the Native community and all the organizations and the recreational people in Juneau who wanted to use it as for trails, for hiking and walking. And they joined forces and fought that and created, there was a new classification of it for recreational use. And so that protected it at that time.
When was it that people realized that they needed to actively protect this land?
Well, it was in that very first 1959 when the Park Service acquired that lot and wanted to develop it. They acquired the land that would have prevented the Juneau community from going down to their herring camps. So that's the first time that happened. And then, like I said, in 1969, it happened again. And then it happened again starting in 1992 through 98 when NOAA wanted to build a fisheries lab there. And that also the native community got together. And we're talking about ANCSA corporations and AMB and ANS, Tlingit Haida and everybody, and Rosita. Got together and said that this could not be used for that purpose because it would destroy the character of the place and it would impact graves and other evidence of native use. That's when there was some archaeology done that showed that Tlingit people had been there for 800 years using the place. And so those are the three times that really show that we put that into the National Register nomination to show how over these years it was always sought to protect and preserve it by the Native community.
So, Chuck, did you pretty much write the document to get this land on the Historic Register?
Well, I finalized it. It had been started before Rosita was involved in an earlier version of it, weren't you?
I have to say that I see Indian Point through a very personal lens. And even though I'm a Chilkat, I grew up knowing that Indian Point belonged to the Auk people, even though they didn't have legal title to it. We were always taught that it was Auk land, and we were always taught that it was a sacred site. And in the late 60s, you know, my mother had died, and I obtained her A&B, A&S Kagena, the sash, and I went through a ceremonial rite that it was to take my mother's place. And my mother had been an advocate for our people. She was very involved in the Salmon Canary Union. She was very involved in working to protect the rights of Native people, trying to seek equity for Native people, seek justice for Native people. And so when I inherited that Kugena, to me, I thought about all the things that my mother had given to us. And I wondered, what am I going to give to the younger generation and my children? And the first event that happened was Indian Point, where the city in the 1969 were going to subdivide it. And so we organized and testified before the city to resist the sale of the land there. And then I come to work for Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, I think it was in 1996, and I find a draft environmental impact statement where they are wanting to develop the site for the NOAA facility. So we immediately protested and said there had been no consultation with the Native community. We began to have a series of meetings with NOAA, and NOAA offers us $1 million and 50 acres of land if we would drop our opposition to the building of the NOAA facility. And our people uniformly, except for one person, said no, they weren't going to take the $1 million or 50 acres, but we wanted to maintain the integrity of that. I had gone to a meeting with the Park Service where they had these keepers of the treasure, and I loved it because it was Indigenous people meeting from all across the country talking about how do we protect our culture. At that meeting, I heard about TCPs, traditional cultural properties, and so I came home and I said, oh, this is what we need. And at the same time, we're having NOAA develop this. And so it was at this point in time that we started our effort to file for this federal designation of traditional cultural properties. And this is where Chuck, that's his area of expertise and dealing with all of those bureaucratic applications and doing all of that kind of work.
So they hired, with Rosita's encouragement, they hired Tom Thornton to write a report on the traditional cultural significance of Indian Point and an evaluation as a traditional cultural property. And so he did that, and then the agency made a determination that it did indeed fit those criteria. But that wouldn't preclude development, so that the communities still fought it, and eventually they won, and it was moved out to Lena Point. After that, there was, I can't remember if Tom or you or both of you wrote a form, submitted the form to the National Register, and that came back with a whole lot of questions, and it sat there for a while.
So that was quite a lengthy process in and of itself, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
I guess when you think about having to go through this bureaucratic maze to achieve something, how big of a maze was this to get on the National Historic Register?
Well, it took a while. It took 20 years from the conclusion of that report until we succeeded, because Tom's report sat there, and then it involved a lot of state and federal agencies to put it through. And I came back here in 2013 and picked up the process, which had kind of come to a halt. And I learned that there had been comments made by the National Register on that initial application that had not been addressed. And the SHPO wasn't really clear about how to proceed. And it was sort of like that. We would go and talk to different groups and find out what needed to be done and sort of stepwise work through the process. But it involved, like, responding to all the comments. There were comments by the Historic Resources Advisory Committee of the CBJ, and all of those comments had to be addressed in order for the National Register to feel like it was appropriate to proceed. But some of these comments, like the one that got me the most, was from the city, you know, referring back to that individual we talked about, the AUK leader, said, well, that's a story, you know, but is that history? Can we consider that historically significant based on a legend? So, we fought back, pushed back, and the National Register agreed with us that, sure, if that's important, culturally important, historically important to the group, then yes, that can be considered a historic person of importance in the history of this area. So that's just one example. But, it went through, and then the Park Service got involved because they were the landowner. So it turns out we had to submit everything through the Park Service, and we didn't learn that until very late in the process because no one told us.
And it took so long that they had a new application form, and so we had to go back and refill out the new form. Ridiculous process.
There must be something maddening when the land was your land to begin with.
It's still our land.
Right. It's still your land. But to have to go through a process like this, how much money did it cost to fight this thing? How much do you think that Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and other organizations spent?
I don't know about A&B, and A&B was involved, A&S involved, Tlingit Naida was involved, Sea Alaska through Sea Alaska Heritage. And for Sea Alaska Heritage, it's 20 years of work with multiple staff, easy, a couple $100,000 in staff time, and just devoting all of our time to these meetings, continuously respond to questions, working with archaeologists to find the latest archaeological evidence. And then also, the federal agencies, of course, had their own people working on it, but for different purposes.
When you visit the land today and you walk upon it, walk near it, what are your feelings about it? Do you sense its sacredness?
Oh, absolutely. It's important to note that there are shamans that are buried out there. And according to our belief system, the spirits of the shamans still reside in that area. And I remember once when the NOAA guy asked me, well, are there any mitigation plans that we could implement to protect the site? And I said, I've never heard about building a fence and the spirits staying within the fence. But I will think about it.
That is so amazing. So they wanted defense in the spirits.
Well, they were asking what mitigation plans could we do to protect those sacred sites where the shamans were buried. And maybe I was being a little facetious, but I said I would think about it. But
there was support by the Park Service and by the Forest Service, an archaeologist who was actually chair of the Historic Resource Advisory Committee in Juneau. They were both very supportive. It wasn't all, fighting the bureaucracy, but a lot of it was.
There are just pieces of land that are inherently sacred. I don't know why that is, but you go there and you do feel something. When people visit this property, even though there's modern development nearby, what kind of meaning does it have for people to be able to have connection with this land?
For us, we know that the spirits of those shamans still inhabit those areas. It's not like Westerners or Christian belief where the spirits of deceased go to a heaven or a hell. Our spirits still reside at those areas. And so when we go there, different protocols for different clans. For example, I'm not of that clan, of the shaman that was buried there. So I can't even go near that site. But I know that the spirit is there, and so I respect that. So that's very different than Western beliefs, where the spirit of the deceased goes elsewhere. For us, the spirits remain there. The other element is that we can't desanctify our sacred sites. For example, churches, they could close down the church and make it a meeting hall and then build a church in a new area. We can't do that in our belief system. So I think those are the important things to remember when trying to understand it, is we're talking about different cultural belief systems between natives and non-natives in this instance.
And so why is it important, Rosita, to preserve that sense of sacredness tied to its original roots and not replace it with some kind of modern concept of sacredness?
Well, as I said, it's a sacred site. It continues to be sacred to us, even though I might not be visiting that particular site. A lot of our people will use that area, for example, to burn food, to transfer it to the spirit world. So where there are these kind of activities that still occur to this day at Indian Point.
You've talked about protecting it, but are there some plans to enhance it in some way, in a traditional way?
Well, let me tell you, even though it is designated on the Federal Register, that doesn't mean that it will be forever protected. If some agency wanted to do something there, they would go through a process. So that Federal Register doesn't mean that it stops all development. So they could go through a process and a decision could be made against us that there could be some development activities there. And so it is not finished for us. For us, I would say that we need to have that land designated or owned by Native people, or say firmly designated that there will be no development there because the existing laws will not protect it from further development. And so we've been looking at ways maybe the city would turn the land over to the Ok people or to the tribe so that it can't be developed. It's not a done deal yet.
Talking with Dr. Rosita Worrell, head of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and Dr. Chuck Smythe, the senior ethnologist at the Institute. When we come back, a look at a new book that's been put together to document Indian Point's history. Juno Afternoon is a production of KTOO's Arts and Culture team. To listen to more interviews on Juno Afternoon or to be on the show yourself, check out our website at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Gunashchish for being here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride. We have been listening to a recent conversation that I had with Dr. Rosita Worrell and Dr. Chuck Smythe from Sea Alaska Heritage Institute about Indian Point, land that's near the ferry terminal, considered sacred to the Thlinkit people. The Institute recently published a book with three research papers that they each wrote, along with Dr. Thomas Thornton. So here's a wonderful book that contains a lot of the documentation and history of Indian Point. And what was the main purpose of a story that has many twists and turns? And people might say, oh, well, you got what you wanted. You won the battle to get this on the Federal Register of historic places, and it's not being developed now. So what is the purpose of the book in your mind other than documenting history?
One of the goals of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is to promote cross-cultural understanding. And so that means that we have to educate people, usually non-Native people, about the cultural significance of Indian Point. The article that I write, it talks about, you know, that the sacred dimensions of Indian Point. Tom's article and Chuck's article talk about the other significant elements. Chuck talked to the historic significance, the meeting between the two different clans. That's history, and that hasn't been written anywhere for people that would have access to it. So we publish these Box of Knowledge series for the general public, for our own people who might not know the history of it, so that it could be available to school teachers and it could be taught in schools.
The other thing is it's not safe now, because at one point it was protected in 69. After that, then the city passed an ordinance saying it was zoned for recreation. But when they did their comprehensive plan, they rezoned it. They didn't tell anyone. It was just part of the plan. And it was embedded in the plan, and no one thought of looking in the plan. So I learned that and went to the Auk Bay area plan meetings and tried to get something inserted into that, because right now it's zoned for commercial development, zoned for residential development. It's not protected.
Well, the book is a fairly small volume, so it's very user-friendly. You can get a quick take on the history by looking at it. What is it about the book that you want people to take away?
Well, I think it's important just to see how the community, the Native community here, has fought and wanted to protect the site, that it has contemporary significance. Everything else on the National Register has to be 50 years or older. So something more modern or more recently declared history, historical, doesn't work for the National Register. Only a traditional cultural property. And the reason why is because that criterion is for having ongoing cultural significance. So I think that's what I would like people to take away, is to realize and see how this place has ongoing cultural significance to the Native community.
Rosita, what takeaway do you hope people have from this book?
I hope that they all come to understand Native belief systems. I always say it helps people to understand differences. And I want people to know that even though we're different, I think we still have the same desires and wanting to protect things that are important to us. And maybe they'll come to understand, you know, some of our belief systems. And I think there are people who have gone along and worked with us to protect this site. I never want to see that site developed. I want future generations of Tlingit people, of Auk people, to know that that site is there in perpetuity, and that it will remain a sacred site.
Nationally, we have a lot of these controversies. There was Bear's Ear, and they wanted to mine there, develop minerals there. And so it's not far-fetched that at any time in the future that a piece of property that's recognized as sacred comes under attack.
Well, I think it's pretty uniform in that it's been a consistent battle for us to try to convince the government and the public that these sites should be protected. It's ongoing. And I don't know if we'll ever have a law that says these sacred sites should be protected in totality and in perpetuity. I don't know if we have that yet.
So before we go, is there something that I didn't think to ask you that was important to include in our conversation?
I just want to emphasize that we recognize that Indian Point belongs to the Auk Kwan. And even though they don't hold title to it, we recognize it as their land. People like myself, a Chilkat, you know, we want to thank the Auk people for allowing us to be able to share in Indian Point, use Indian Point for its sacred dimensions, and maybe someday the herring will come back and we'll be able to go back there and gather herring eggs.
Chuck, is there a possibility that that area could see a resurgence of herring?
Oh, I don't know.
Not unless they move all the houses out.
pretty much has the habitat for the herring been destroyed?
Well, they keep incrementally taking it away. There's that fish processing plant there. And supposedly there was an easement that was given to them to build that plant in return for planting eelgrass somewhere. And that would offset that fish processing plant. But I don't think anyone's ever evaluated that to see if that occurred. So, you know, the ferry system is going to be doing something more on the ferry terminal. So all of that incrementally, you know, it's going to be really difficult unless that stops or unless there's some boundary placed around that area.
It's kind of hard to imagine the world that people had with that kind of abundance, that in a matter of 100 years that you lose a herring fishery.
Well, we have to remember that our Southeast Native people, our land is a land of abundance. We were very wealthy in our culture. We were very wealthy economically. We lost our land base. Maybe there hasn't been that extensive development on Indian Point. Nevertheless, we don't own it, and we should own it. And I hope that sometime, you know, people will do, in my mind, the right thing and return it back to the Auk people, return it back to the Tlingit people.
So how many acres are we talking about?
You know, the important thing about Indian Point is that it's not just that one little specific sites. It's the entire Auk Cape and the adjacent lands around it, and even the island is considered to be that sacred area, sacred landscape.
You say you'd like to have the land come back into Alaska Native ownership. So who owns that land? Are there several landowners involved?
The Park Service, BLM, and the city. We tried to select it as a historic and sacred sites under RC Alaska land legislation, but we were not allowed to do that.
The thing I wonder about as I try to picture this land, and I've never stepped on it, the kind of impact that it has on the people who it originally belonged to. How does it affect them? Does it make them feel things? Does it connect them? And maybe the shamanic landscape has something to do with it. I don't know, Chuck.
Well, it connects them to their history, and it connects them to some cultural beliefs and practices. And one of them is that when a shaman is buried, the power of the shaman still resides there in that place, even though his remains may have been removed. And so the power of the shaman in a place like this extends beyond just the physical grave and the physical place where he may have been laid to rest. And so it's both positive and negative, because it can be also dangerous to people. You can suffer consequences. You know, there's been instances where I've consulted with other tribes and other communities where they talked about shaman burial in relation to, like, for example, a highway project, talked about it to the Federal Highways Administration, and then they started to suffer. Things happened to their family, and so they would never return to a meeting to talk about it again. So the idea of this shamanic landscape is drawn in the boundaries of this traditional cultural property, in that it extends offshore for a distance, and including some of the islands. The boundaries aren't just the actual physical land, but it goes beyond that for that reason.
And of course, that's probably something that can only be known with our sixth sense, which is rarely ever part of public policy. We want to thank our guests, Dr. Rosita Worrell, head of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, and Dr. Chuck Smythe, the Institute's senior ethnologist, for giving us some things to think about today and a better appreciation for the land called Indian Point, also known as Unakai.